Lately, accusations of presidential wrongdoing have raised questions, and one in particular that came up during the Watergate era. Can a president be indicted? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. And my guest is UW-Madison Professor of Law Emeritus and former federal prosecutor Frank Turkheimer. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you, Norman. It's a pleasure to be here.
I gather there's always a danger in making too many parallels between what has happened in the whole Watergate phenomenon and what might be happening in 2017, 2018 with the Trump administration. But in terms of the legalities, there are maybe some questions that have been wrestled with in the past that will return in the current situation. And your involvement with the Watergate proceedings gives you some really good insights into what those questions would be and how they might be answered. So what were the real questions that came up, the precedents, you might even say, that you had to deal with in Watergate?
Well, I assume that the main thing you're talking about, of course, is whether a sitting president can be indicted. And that's a question which we faced after we received the tape recordings sought by the grand jury, which included a tape recording of the president basically telling John Dean to continue the conspiracy to obstruct justice, where the president said, if you need $1 million, I know where we can get it. We can get it in cash.
The famous smoking gun.
No, the smoking gun was a later tape.
Oh, really? This sounds like it would have a lot of smoke coming out of it,
well,
too.
We did, too. And it was certainly enough for us to feel that the president should be named as a co-conspirator in the Watergate indictment. There was no broad sentiment that while he was president that he should be indicted. But it was a practical judgment rather than a theoretical one, because there was an ongoing viable impeachment process going on. The House Judiciary Committee had been activated and was seriously looking into some of the same facts we were looking into. So there was no strong sentiment that the president should be indicted. Then, of course, the president resigned in early August, and by that time the evidence became even stronger, because that time we had the smoking gun tape that you alluded to, where it shows that the president and his principal aide agreed they would have the CIA lie to the FBI about an ongoing investigation in Mexico to curtail an FBI investigation that was about to uncover a link between the burglars and the committee to reelect the president.
So obstruction of justice?
Absolutely. A clear obstruction of justice. And I've got to say, there was a rift on our staff. I don't think I'm telling any secrets, that most of the staff felt that at this point the ex-president, should be indicted. And Leon Jaworski, who was a special prosecutor, felt otherwise. He claimed that the president could not get a fair trial, that the publicity would be too much. We thought that was a bogus argument. But this was during August, and as you know, in Washington, D.C., not much happens in August. And by the time everything got back in place in September, the president was pardoned, and that mooted the issue about whether the president should be indicted. I think the governing sentiment appears to be that the president can't be indicted. He has to be impeached and removed before he can be indicted. And in a sense, that's a little, it sort of puts the president above the law, because, if he commits a crime and is not indicted and the statute of limitations runs, he's home free. But the ultimate point, of course, is that the president can pardon himself.
Yes.
So you indict the president and he pardons himself and it's the end of it. So I don't think we need be concerned. I don't think it's going to happen, no matter what the facts are. It's more of a theoretical discussion than a real one.
I didn't want to pass over entirely, though, unless it's a totally irrelevant thing. Spiro T. Agnew, who was vice president, he came under legal heat also and resigned.
Yeah.
And was that any kind? I mean, would the vice president also be above this indictment?
Well, Well, then, you know, I mean, impeachment doesn't just run to the president. It runs to the vice president, runs to cabinet officers. I believe early on, one of our attorney generals was impeached and removed from office. I think the concept of non-indictability would apply only to the president. After all, the vice president can't pardon himself. And in the Agnew case, it was all wrapped up into one deal. He resigns, he pleads no contest to a tax charge, and the recommendation would be that he not go to jail. It was all bundled together in one deal, which worked very smoothly.
There seems to be a kind of an underlying philosophical thought about this, which I think was a big part of President Gerald Ford pardoning Nixon, and that was legalities aside, or criminality aside, it's overall better for the country not to go through this process of indicting and prosecuting a president or a vice president.
That's right. And I totally was sympathetic with President Ford's statement that he could not further his national agenda while the question was open, that when he had a press conference and wanted to talk about this plan or that plan or that plan that he wanted to implement, all he got was questions about ex-President Nixon. And he decided that it was in the national interest of his ability to run the executive department and implement what he was supposed to do, that the issue be put behind him. He would take whatever political heat came with it, which he did, and he pardoned the president. We knew that was coming because what happened was sometime in mid or late August, we got a request from the White House to list all possible crimes that may have been committed by Richard Nixon. Now, you know, once you got past obstruction of justice and Watergate and one or two other things, it became a more of a theoretical list than a real list. But that certainly portended the coming pardon. And as it turned out, that's what happened.
And there was arguably a political price that Gerald Ford paid in that he was not elected in his own right as president 2 years later.
I'm sure.
Well, let's get a little bit more into the mechanics of the whole Watergate thing and then, compare with what might be the legalities of the Trump situation. Now, you mentioned this list of crimes that are attributed to the Nixon administration other than obstruction of justice. What all did they include? And do you think they were also adequate for a prosecution if it were to be pursued?
Well, certainly the obstruction of justice crime was not only viable, but a very, very powerful case. Look, the president would not have resigned had he not known that the case against him was strong. And he, at the time President Nixon resigned, he knew that he had very little support on the Hill. After that smoking gun tape came out, the House Judiciary Committee voted 38-0 to impeach the president.
A bipartisan group.
That was 17 Republicans joined 21 Democrats, and that certainly foretold an impeachment by the House. And if you have a 38-0 vote among a body that's relatively conservative, and the Judiciary Committee was, your future in the Senate is not promising. And I think Senator Goldwater, Minority Leader Scott, and maybe one other went to the president and told him that his support in the Senate was waning and that they would even vote against him. And then he knew the game was up, and he resigned. But in terms of other crimes, I think one would have to get a little bit, it gets a little closer to see whether Richard Nixon engaged in other crimes. The activities related to the IRS, which he thought it was stacked against him, and some of the political activities that he engaged in, the potential. I think Watergate was it.
The burglary and then
the cover up of the burglary, his involvement in the cover up of the burglary.
When you mentioned the IRS, Frank, are you referring to Nixon sort of sicking the IRS on political enemies?
Well, yeah, creating an enemies list. You see, it becomes a little more difficult to fit this into a violation of the federal penal code when you take the enemies list using the IRS to go after enemies. I mean, because After all, enforcement of the Internal Revenue Code is a legitimate presidential function, an executive function. So the lines start to get a little blurry, which is why I say that it was Watergate.
Did Nixon succeed in obstructing justice?
I don't think so. Most of the people who were guilty of crimes were convicted. A few eluded justice through fortuities. There was one defendant in the cover-up case, a man by the name of Mardian, who was Assistant Attorney General in charge of, internal security, whose main lawyer had a heart attack or something during the trial, and he was then severed. And the Watergate Special Prosecution Force did not want to put the resources into a whole new trial of the conspiracy in order to try Mardian. And so he went off. There was another person, an aide to Haldeman, the guy who took the transcripts that resulted from the original Watergate break-in. Remember, there were two break-ins of the Watergate. The first one installed the taps, and the second one, which is the one where they were caught, was the effort to fix a defective tap.
It's kind of hard to believe. It was hard to believe then. It's just as hard to believe now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something so amateurish would have been sanctioned by the White House.
Right. So the point is that there were transcripts prepared of these taps, what these taps showed. And the fellow who took them from the committee to reelect the president to the White House to give them to Haldeman, the president's principal assistant, he also eluded prosecution. But on the scheme of things, these are relatively minor people. And I don't think one can lament a failure of justice with respect to what happened in Watergate.
Does it matter that the obstruction of justice was unsuccessful?
Well, it was successful for a while, that's for sure.
So, is it a crime either way?
Well,
if you're successful or just attempt to obstruct.
No, this is a very significant difference between the penal codes of most states and the federal penal code is that in most states it's a crime to do ABC, and then there's also a general attempt statute. Anyone who attempts to do ABC is punishable by usually half the amount that the underlying crime takes. There's no such statute in the federal penal code, but it's built into the obstruction statute. And the obstruction statute provides that anyone who, and I'm parsing it here, anyone who corruptly endeavors to impede the due administration of justice is guilty of a crime, which basically means whoever attempts or tries to obstruct justice, you don't have to succeed, is guilty of a crime. And that's a fairly broad statute.
And we'll get into this a little bit later, but if the attempt to obstruct justice comes in the form of a conversation in which you say to somebody who is in a position to investigate you or your administration, I expect loyalty, and I hope you'll let this whole thing go away, that could be construed as an attempt to obstruct justice?
That could be construed as an endeavor to impede the due administration of justice. And there has to be a corrupt intent. If the president, for example, were to say, I've reviewed the evidence here, and I'm ultimately the chief law enforcement officer of the country, and I don't think there's enough evidence here for this person to be charged, and I think you should drop the case against them, I think that would be okay, or close to okay. But if you're not talking about that kind of a fair, objective review of the evidence, if you're just saying, I hope that you drop the investigation against this person and threaten and imply sanctions if that directive is not followed, I think one can say that that slots into a corrupt endeavor to impede the due administration of justice.
Now, the Watergate proceedings all really hinged on those tapes, didn't it?
Absolutely. Without the tapes, there wasn't enough evidence.
And so far as we know, there's no tape recording of Donald Trump talking to Comey about this conversation, in this conversation that Comey claims made him feel that he was being asked to lay off.
That is true. And I think most prosecutors, when faced with he said version where the president says, no, I never said that, and Comey says he did, would be inclined to say I can't prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The one thing, and I was a little disappointed in the press, maybe you picked it up somewhere, I didn't, that when the president was being asked about that and gave his version, I didn't hear anyone ask him, why did you ask the other people to leave the room? You know, I can't understand that. I mean, if there's circumstantial corroboration for Comey's version as opposed to the president's version, it's his clearing the room. And nobody, as far as I can understand, asked what I think is it's not profound. It's not rocket science. It's a simple question. Why'd you ask them to leave the room?
I mean, do we have other examples of that where it's the president's word against somebody else's as to what was said or done in the situation? I mean, has this ever come up before? Did it come up during Watergate?
Well, of course it came up during Watergate. I mean, the president denied any knowledge of the conspiracy to obstruct justice, and John Dean said you were in the middle of it. And, you know, without the tapes, I don't think that would have gone very far. I mean, it was not only did the president deny it, but his principal aides denied it as well. It wasn't even a one-on-one. It was John Dean against the president, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell against the whole bunch.
I wanted to just look for a second at what the Constitution says about impeachment. It says, this is Article 1, Section 3, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. But the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. How do you interpret that in terms of the options in a case of presidential wrongdoing?
Well, I think that's why President Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, because he, under that provision of the Constitution, clearly Richard Nixon was prosecutable for crimes relating to Watergate. The president is vulnerable to that unless he pardons himself.
Well, and that raises an interesting question. At what point would the president, let's say Nixon in this case, be in a position to pardon himself? You can get pardoned without actually being convicted? Is that what happened in the Nixon case?
Oh, of course, and that's not terribly unusual, I think. At the beginning, or maybe it was the end of the Carter presidency, weren't a whole lot of Americans who went to Canada to avoid the draft pardoned? They hadn't been prosecuted. There's no requirement that there be a charge or a conviction to instigate a pardon. You can be pardoned for any misdeeds that you've committed, whether they've been charged or not.
So why do you suppose Nixon didn't pardon himself?
I'm not sure. I think, I don't know. I can't answer that question.
But it's pretty clear that there was no discussion with Gerald Ford about, if I appoint you vice president, you'll pardon me.
Well, as you may remember, that was a source of controversy.
Sure.
And the president, and President Ford, I mean, to his credit, then shortly afterwards went before the joint committee of the House and Senate and answered any question they wanted answered about that. And I think he made a convincing case that there wasn't a deal. I think there are people around, or there were at that time, who felt that there was an understanding. But I think the general consensus, with which I would agree, is that President Ford did not reach an understanding with President Nixon that if Nixon would resign, Ford would pardon him.
Ford did have credibility. I mean, he was well liked in Congress and had a long track record.
Yeah, I'll tell you where Ford's credibility is. An interesting historical irony. He was, you may remember, was minority leader in the House, which incidentally is one of the colossal differences between the situation then and the situation now. At that time, we have a Republican president, and the Democrats controlled both houses. Now we have a Republican president, and the Republicans control both houses. I don't think one can overlook that distinction. But the thing is, when a few years before the Nixon issue, there was a question as to whether Justice Douglas should be impeached. Then Minority Leader Ford, when asked what is an impeachable offense, made the statement, whatever the House thinks is impeachable. Now, of course, those words were thrust back at him, you know, a couple of years later. But it actually remains, I think, an accurate statement that, you know, if the House thinks it's impeachable, it is impeachable. And then does the Senate concur by a two-thirds vote, or don't they? Notwithstanding, I mean, the terminology high crimes and misdemeanors is open to interpretation. And there's no judicial review of this. You know, you can't, if you are impeached and removed, you can't appeal to the courts. The Congress has the final say on this.
Yeah, it's an interesting apportioning of the balance of powers, isn't
very,
it?
Very.
What do you suppose misdemeanors means, though? I've always been perplexed by that combination. High crimes, I get, but misdemeanors? I mean, we've had a couple of sitting presidents who were, you know, stopped for traffic violations back in the day, U.S. Grant, and I think Franklin Pierce was the other one for riding their horses too fast in the streets of Washington. But in a practical sense, what does that mean, misdemeanors, do you think?
I don't know what it means. I really don't. I mean, President Johnson was indicted for violating the Tenure of Office Act. It means, I think Gerald Ford was right when he said it means whatever the House says it means. It's a vague term, and it's a political question, not a legal question.
I want to revisit in a minute the steps to impeachment, just so that we're clear on that, and then we'll look again at the current situation and see how different that might be from precedents that were established in the Watergate era. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Frank Turkheimer, UW-Madison Professor of Law Emeritus and a former federal prosecutor who was involved in the Watergate proceedings. And we're looking at various presidents and precedents having to do with can a president be indicted, for example, and what forces would come into play under those circumstances. Special prosecutor is a kind of a recurring theme, certainly in the Watergate phenomenon. It was a headline story day after day. What exactly is the role of a special prosecutor? Who hires him? Who has control over his investigations? And ultimately, who can fire him?
This is the subject of federal regulations. We've been wrestling with this problem for a good generation. Because we've had special prosecutors where the cases, the matters have dragged on and on and on, started with potential, for example, with respect to President Clinton, it began with Whitewater and whether this was there financial, were there financial misdeeds by the president, and it ended up with sexual relations with the presidential aide, Monica Lewinsky. And In the 80s, the independent counsel's investigation went on for a long, long time. They've gone on for a long time. And we as a country, and Congress in particular, and the Justice Department have wrestled with this for quite a while. And the present status of it is that if the attorney general, or if he's disqualified, an acting attorney general, which is the situation we're in right now, feels that it is... that there's a matter going on which can only be conducted more independently of the administration, the attorney general or the acting attorney general is authorized to appoint a special counsel to conduct an investigation, who then functions exactly as a U.S. attorney, but who obviously has broad discretion, but must comply with department policies, and removal is limited to things such as conflict of interest, incapacity, or I think, is Rosenstein, the present deputy attorney general, who is the acting attorney general for these purposes, said for good cause. And you can't just get rid of him legally because you want to get rid of him. It has to fit one of these provisions that's in the regulations.
However, the catch is that, let's say, this special counsel, or they're sometimes called special prosecutors?
Well, they used to be. The terminology that the regulations refer to now, and if we want to be precise, and I don't care, it's special counsel is the terminology.
Which is certainly a more neutral
exactly.
title.
Exactly.
That individual, okay, works for the U.S. Attorney General, who in turn works for the president. So if this special counsel is sniffing out things that reflect badly on the president does have the ability to sack this special counsel slash prosecutor.
Indirectly. The rules, the regulations specifically provide that only the attorney general can get rid of or fire the special counsel, which is exactly the format that happened in Watergate and led to the Saturday Night Massacre.
Because Nixon, then, in order to get to this special prosecutor, Archibald Cox?
Briefly, and I'll try to make this very brief.
It went on for years, of course.
Cox had gotten a grand jury subpoena for some presidential tape recordings after the existence of the tape recordings was divulged in the summer of 1973. The president's office moved to kill the subpoena, or the legal term is to quash the subpoena on executive privilege grounds. The district court judge, Judge Sirica, denied the motion to quash, upheld the validity of the subpoena. The president appealed. The Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia also upheld the subpoena. And historically, that was on October 12, 1973. And that's significant because the president had 7 days in which to ask for the Supreme Court to review the case. On October 19th, a Friday, the clerk's office kept itself open for an extra hour. They were afraid the president might get caught in the rush hour, and they didn't want history to turn on a rush hour on Pennsylvania.
On one traffic jam.
So, but the president didn't appeal. Instead, he decided to fire Cox or have Cox accept. He made a proposal that Senator Stennis, an elderly, very elderly conservative Democrat from Mississippi, could look at the tapes and authenticate a transcript of the tapes. Cox refused to accept that, and Nixon decided to fire him. But as was the case now, under the regulations, in effect, the president couldn't. It had to be the attorney general. The attorney general, Elliot Richardson, when he was confirmed, when he appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier that year in the spring, promised he would appoint a special prosecutor who would be removed only if he engaged in extraordinary improprieties. And he was confirmed with that promise. And his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, made the same commitment to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So when the president tells Elliot Richardson, I want you to fire Cox, Richardson says, well, all he's done is insist on what the courts say he's entitled to. That's hardly an extraordinary impropriety. I can't do it. And then there was a historically very interesting debate between the president and his attorney general about what was the public interest. And they obviously differed. And Richardson resigned. And then now it's Ruckelshaus' turn. And I think he was fired. I don't think he resigned because he, too, refused to fire Cox. And then the next person in line is the solicitor general, who was Robert Bork. Bork had been solicitor for about 2.5 years. Obviously, he made no commitment to the Senate Judiciary Committee because it wasn't an issue, was not an issue. And he fired Cox. Ultimately, it was illegal. The Cox firing was illegal because there were no extraordinary improprieties. But that determination wasn't made until months later on by a judge in a case called Nader v. Bork. Ralph Nader sued Bork and had the firing declared illegal. So the way it has to work now is, since the president can't fire Mueller, he's got to tell Rosenstein, you have to fire Mueller. And then that's where we can have a scenario that roughly parallels the Watergate scenario. If Rosenstein says, I don't think he's done anything that's, you know, it's not, there's no, nothing that satisfies the regulations, then the president has to fire Rosenstein. And then up comes the next person, and then we see how far that goes.
Well, as we saw in Watergate, there was a political price to pay, although Nixon constitutionally had the authority to fire the attorney general and then use that indirectly to fire that special prosecutor. There was a huge outcry in the press and in among the public, too, which only seemed to accelerate the demise of the president.
There is no question that what we call the Saturday Night Massacre was the turning point in the Watergate story, because until then, there may have been five members of the House who called for the impeachment of the president. After the Saturday Night Massacre, the impeachment process was set in motion. And you're right, it was a public outcry. You know, it's almost hard to envision that today, because you can send these mass emails and you have no idea of what the true sentiment is. But back in those days, people had to go to Western Union and send telegrams that cost money and effort and time. And Congress and the president's office were deluged with millions of telegrams. And that, in that sense, the public input into the process was critical to make impeachment something that was merely abstract and theoretical and turn it into something that was real.
Well, now, of course, impeachment had come up once more, impeachment, not removal, way back in Reconstruction and with Andrew Johnson, which impeachment failed, I think, by just one vote.
Removal failed.
Yeah, removal, right. And then it came up again, as we've alluded to, during the Clinton administration. And what do you think were the mechanisms behind that? I mean, in compared to a lot of things we've been talking about, it seems to have been minor.
Well, not only, to me, the big difference between the Clinton matter and the Nixon matter is that at the time of the Nixon matter, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Peter Rodino, was emphatic that this had to be a bipartisan thing. This couldn't be, you can't have a partisan impeachment and removal, because if you do that, you convert our democracy into a parliamentary democracy. I mean, that's a fundamental change.
A dangerous precedent.
Dangerous, terribly dangerous precedent. And Rodino was tremendously concerned to be sure that it was a bipartisan effort. And, for example, the general counsel to the majority in the House Judiciary Committee was a Republican, John Doerr from Wisconsinite, there was a bipartisan vote on three of the impeachment articles. At the time of the Clinton matter, it was perfectly obvious that this was not going to be bipartisan. When the House voted to impeach the president, virtually all Republicans voted for it, and virtually all Democrats voted against it. And given the break, the constitution of the Senate, like, 55-45 or something like that, you clearly were not going to get 67 votes to remove the president. So it was an effort that was doomed to fail, but not just doomed to fail, but in my opinion, it tied up the president needlessly. The late 90s were a critical time in terms of al-Qaeda. If you remember, the embassies were bombed,
yes,
in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. The destroyer coal was hit. And the president should have been paying attention. And that's what he should have been focusing on. Instead, he had to defend himself. So there's a huge difference between the Clinton matter and the Nixon matter. With Clinton, he was impeached for lying under oath by denying a sexual affair with an intern.
And why was the sexual affair even an issue? I mean, the lying, of course, it's almost parallel to Watergate in that the burglary itself at Watergate was so stupid and so amateurish and so petty in a way and so pointless too. And you know, there have been no doubt many dalliances in the White House with interns and other people over the years.
There might even have been a few on the Hill.
Yes, perhaps so. Why is lying about this dalliance with Monica Lewinsky an issue?
Well, it's an issue because of the looseness of the terms high crimes and misdemeanors. Lying, if you lie under oath, technically it's a felony. And that if the House says that that's a high crime and misdemeanor, it's a high crime and misdemeanor. I mean,
that happened to be a Republican House, and that's how they defined it at the time.
And I really think Gerald Ford was right when he said high crime and misdemeanor is what the House says it is.
But the danger in that is if the House is partisan one way or the other, then you've got a lever there.
It's a danger which happily we have avoided in this country all but one time, and that is the Clinton impeachment.
You know, we haven't, Frank, talked about civil suits against presidents, and there have been some of those. And is the president not immune from civil suits?
Well, also in connection with President Clinton's sexual dalliances, he was sued civilly by
Paula Jones?
Paula Jones in Arkansas, and she brought the suit in federal court in the district court in Arkansas, and the president claimed that that suit should be held in abeyance until he's no longer president. And the Supreme Court, in what I think was most people think it was a fairly naive decision, said, well, defending himself in a civil suit isn't going to
distract
him very much.
His,
so he has to give his deposition, maybe testify at a trial. Therefore, it is perfectly permissible for a president to be sued civilly while president, that's the state of the law right now.
And well, there have been civil suits. There was one initiated, at least, against Donald Trump, but that was resolved having to do with Trump University. That was resolved out of court just before he took office.
That's right. But there were, after the Access Hollywood tape came out during the campaign, there was at least one and possibly more lawsuits brought against him by women claiming that they had been sexually assaulted to be president. And as I understand it, I've tried, in anticipation of our talk, I tried to look it up a little bit, and all I found is that these are state cases, and the president's lawyers claim that Clinton v. Jones does not apply to a case brought in state court as opposed to a federal court. I for one, don't really see the distinction, but it is a distinction, and it's one they're making, and the issue is pending before the courts.
I wonder sometimes why these cases are pursued as civil cases rather than criminal cases. I mean, if it's a case of, say, sexual assault,
well, sexual assault,
criminal offense.
It's a felony. I think we may have a statute of limitations problem with respect to many of these cases that with respect to criminal law, but it hasn't happened. There have been none, and I don't think we can anticipate any.
And I gather that that statements of attitude on behalf of a president really would not play in court one way or the other. In other words, he is on tape saying, you know, that you can, in effect, you know, sexually assault a woman, and it's part of your...
No. I disagree with you. Uh-huh. I think it's not... He didn't say you can. He said he did.
Uh-huh. Oh, did he?
I think that if you take a he said, she said case where a woman claims that she was assaulted by to be president, and he denies it, and you put her testimony together with a tape recording in which he acknowledges doing the very thing that she claims he did, I think you have a very, very strong civil case. I mean, that's a dream case for a plaintiff's lawyer. I mean, normally, as we can see with Cosby, these cases are very difficult because women tend to complain not right away for reasons
that... And sometimes years go by.
Years go by. There are experts who will testify as to why that's the case. And these cases are very difficult. This, where you have an open acknowledgement of the very conduct that would be alleged in a civil case, I think it's powerful.
Do you have a sense that more of these are likely to emerge? I mean, it's often the case, isn't it, that one or two people come by or come forward and claim, you know, an assault or some kind of actionable offense, and then others come out? You know, certainly in the Cosby case, that happened.
That my guess, I wouldn't even say it's an educated guess, is that if Access Hollywood didn't trigger, if the divulgence of the Access Hollywood tape did not trigger a civil lawsuit, it's not going to happen. I can't imagine somebody not bringing that suit within a few weeks or so of the Access Hollywood tape and then bringing it several years later on. So in my opinion, whatever there is, is out there.
Let's look further at the legalities of suing or prosecuting a sitting president when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Frank Turkheimer, UW-Madison Professor of Law Emeritus and former federal prosecutor who was involved in the Watergate proceedings. And we're looking at some of the other instances in American history, both current and previous, that have bearing on that phenomenon. In particular, can a president be indicted? We did touch, Frank, on this issue of the practicalities, let's say, legalities aside, you might, as a president, have the legal right to remove, say, a special counsel or a special prosecutor. But in the case of Nixon, we saw there was a tremendous political price to pay in terms of the public outcry. But are we poised, do you think, for a similar situation in the current position of things?
I think it's a mistake to assume that there's an inevitable parallel between the consequences of the firing of Archibald Cox and Mr. Mueller. And I say that because at the time of Watergate, I mean, you had an electorate that was truly interested and truly following the Watergate hearings when the Senate Select Committee was holding hearings in the spring. They were nationally televised. And the country as a whole was pretty much following it with great attention. I think we're far more polarized now, and I don't think that we can assume that if we were to have a modern Saturday night massacre where the president tells Rosenstein to fire Mueller, Rosenstein refuses, Rosenstein gets fired, somebody else comes in his place, and that person fires Mueller, I don't think we can assume that there will be a comparable outcry that will lead to a serious impeachment effort by the House of Representatives. And, you know, it's just a different time. I think, you know, one of the very accurate and truthful things that President Trump said during the campaign was he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and he wouldn't lose a vote. Well, I think he was right. And if he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose a vote, what will be the political consequences of these technical firings? It's not nearly as bad as shooting someone on Fifth Avenue. And I think and he knows this. You know, he knows that it's not the same thing. And he may be, at some point, he may be tempted to just get rid of the whole thing.
What is Special Counsel Mueller actually looking for?
Well, the statute that enables the office says that he is looking into those areas that have been delegated to him by the Attorney General, the acting Attorney General, which obviously includes any efforts of collusion between the president's election campaign and Russia. The statute also specifically gives the special counsel the authority to look into possible perjury or obstruction of justice in connection with any matter that is assigned to him, so that his mandate in that sense is fairly broad.
And so Mr. Comey, former director of the FBI, was looking for the same thing, or were there other issues too involved in these investigations?
Not that I'm aware of.
It all had to do with the possible connection between the president's circle, such as Jared Kushner, for example, or maybe one of his sons, and the Russians. But even if one of those individuals, for example, were to be implicated, then the president could still deny that, well, I didn't know, or would that not hold water?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the mandate, that Mueller's mandate, is not circumscribed by the president. If persons in the presidential campaign worked with the Russians to provide information that would be detrimental to Hillary Clinton and that was designed to influence the outcome of the election, I think they could be prosecuted. And I think it would be, among other things, I mean, there are specific statutes that relate to dealings with foreign officials, but there's a general conspiracy statute, it's a crime to conspire to defraud the United States, and that has been defined by the Supreme Court as a conspiracy to impair or obstruct the government in the exercise of any of its lawful functions, which certainly includes a presidential election. So that there's ample statutory basis for Special Counsel Mueller to look into possible violations by persons other than the president.
Such as Mr. Flynn.
Mr. Flynn. And here's this gets a little tricky. I remember reading an article in the paper about 2-3 weeks ago about how Mueller has hired someone whose expertise is in flipping. You remember that?
Yes.
Yes. And flipping meaning that you take somebody who is vulnerable, who can be prosecuted, and the case against that person is fairly strong, and by pressuring that person, you get that person to acknowledge guilt and provide evidence against others, and in exchange for, you know, a more lenient sentence that would otherwise be the case. And that, that flipping power is very important. Now, in the Watergate case, of course, technically John Dean was flipped. Dean didn't need a whole lot of pushing to be flipped. He was almost self-motivated, but technically John Dean was flipped. Here's the problem with flipping is that the president can remove that flipping power from the special counsel by pardons.
So the special counsel would not have the leverage to say, well, we won't prosecute you if you testify the way we want. However, somebody like Flynn could say, well, president's going to pardon me anyway, so you don't have that leverage.
Well, I don't know if he would say he's going to pardon me. I think he could say he has pardoned me.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the president could pardon him tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the only heat you get for that is political heat, which is one of the reasons why, we both know that historically the most controversial pardons come during the last days of December.
Yes.
Of the last year of a president's.
That's right. What does he have to lose?
Yeah, what does he have to lose? He's in 2 weeks he's going to be out. And so presidents, there's very little political heat. That happened with Caspar Weinberger by President Bush. It happened with Clinton with, was it Mark Rich or the Rich pardon?
I mean,
it's a bipartisan easy way out for a pardon that perhaps shouldn't be made, but for which there is no political heat because it comes at the end of the administration. But it doesn't have to come at the end. Scooter Libby was pardoned before the end of the Bush administration, or at least his sentence was commuted by President Bush. He wasn't totally pardoned. It's just the jail part of his sentence was, and I don't know that President Bush took a lot of heat for that.
No, I wouldn't say so. Pretty minor in the scheme of things. What about conflict of interest? I mean, is that something that a special counsel is going to be interested in, or does it even come into play in the long run?
Well, conflict of interest comes into play in a way that the special counsel doesn't appreciate. That is, one of the grounds upon which you can be removed is if there is a conflict of interest. And there is an issue with respect to the representation of Jared Kushner. He's represented by a woman in the firm of Wilmer Hale, which is also the firm from which Bill Mueller came. He was a partner there. So, but you know, but is there an actual conflict in the sense that Kushner's lawyer consulted with Mueller to get advice, and that, apparently that never took place. And so most people whose field is, whose expertise is in ethics say that as long as there was no actual, or no actual overlaps between Miller and Kushner's lawyer, that's not a conflict of interest that requires that he remove himself.
Have to take those attorneys' words for it, that there was no discussion, no overlap?
I think that's right. I mean, they both say it, Kushner's lawyer and Miller.
In terms of conflict of interest, though, what about sheer presidential profiting from being a public official?
Yes, there are several cases that have been brought claiming that the Emoluments Clause is being violated. The Emoluments Clause is a provision in the Constitution which says that the president shall not receive anything of value from any foreign power. And that's one component of conflict. The other is simply that the president has not abandoned his business interests and stands to, and, you know, and some of his interests are the subject of federal regulation. And the question is, can a regulator really fairly deal with the president's property when the regulator knows that at the other end of the line is the president of the United States? These are new issues that we haven't faced before, because, as you know, President Trump is the first president who was neither comes from the political field nor the military. And obviously, there's nothing wrong with that per se, but he comes from the business field and has not disentangled himself from his business interests. Normally, that's a simple thing for presidents to do. They own stock, and they put it in a blind trust, so they have no idea where it's invested, so it can't conceivably influence any of their decisions as president. That's not the case with President Trump. He knows what his business interests are, and theoretically, he can influence governmental decisions that have a favorable impact on his, on his business. Coupled with, as a separate question, the emoluments issue, the question of the conflict of interest. I mean, the president said the conflict of interest provisions in the laws don't apply to him.
And what was he referring to when he said that? Him personally or him as the president?
As the president, as the president. But nevertheless, there are practices and standards that have evolved over the years that do apply to presidents and to persons in the executive or the president's advisors, which in this case, of course, include his daughter and his son-in-law. And we're on new terrain here with respect to this. And it just remains to be seen to what extent this will be an issue. The emoluments question is separate because that's constitutional. And that says you can't receive anything, as I mentioned, of value from a foreign power. And then there's this question of, foreign powers going to the president's hotels and, and then he says, any profits that I make, I'm going to donate to charity. We're going to get into some big time accounting issues.
Yes, that's right. It's going to be a real industry for the accountants.
Yeah. I mean, because, if I know that, the president of France is staying at a certain hotel, I might want to go there myself. And your occupancy rate is going to go up.
And apparently it's already happened.
Yeah. And are all profits? He's not promised to donate all the profits, just those specifically attributable to the president of France being in the
hotel.
Could
be a little hard to determine.
So this is an issue that there have been several lawsuits abroad. I think the main problem in these lawsuits is one of standing. Who has the standing to bring these cases? And I think in one of the lawsuits, members of Congress have joined as plaintiff. And I think their standing argument is the strongest because Congress has the power under the Constitution, has the power to allow for emoluments. I mean, consent can be given by Congress to the presidential receipt of something from a foreign power. So when you have a lawsuit that's brought by members of Congress, the standing to sue question is a little easier. The hurdle is a little lower. And those cases remain to be resolved.
It will be interesting to see if new laws emerge based on
the experiences. It will. There's no question that new law will emerge. We just don't know what the bottom line is going to be.
Well, Frank Turkheimer, it's been a pleasure going through some of these cases and some speculation, too, as to what the future might hold. Always a pleasure to have you on University of the Air.
Thank you. As always, it's a pleasure chatting with you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can be listening next time for University of the Air.